Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 18 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. Today we are joined for part one of our two-part conversation with Rachel Pye Jones, who shares with us about what she's learned about faith from living across cultures.
What was the highlight for you this week?
I think a highlight for me this week was we planted some pansies and they're just really pretty. I don't know. We went to a new greenhouse that we hadn't gone to before, a nursery, you know, and it was a really fun place. I kind of wish that we had found it years earlier, but yeah, they had a buy one, get one free deal on pansies. And so we loaded up a whole cart full of flowers. And yeah,
I think generally you like gardening, right?
Oh yeah. We love gardening. Mm-hmm. That's one thing we're going to miss when we move, because we won't get to do, we'll probably be in an apartment. So
Yeah, we don't have a ton of space for gardening in our yard, but Jill loves gardening. I just have zero interest. This isn't to diminish your highlight, my friend. I don't know what it is. I haven't been interested, but I mean, I appreciate the end results of it. That's for sure.
Right.
And we have friends who have a garden where they plant like potatoes and everything. And some of the best potatoes I've ever had in my life come out of their garden. And I'm like, man, that's why it's a reason to also, you know, do vegetable garden and all that.
Yep. Yeah. How about for you? What's the highlight been?
It's a little self-serving, but yeah, I've been working on finishing up these edits to get my book published, which is my dissertation, but I've been modifying it and making good progress on it. But over the past couple of weeks, I've had a chance just to kind of shoot a few questions at a couple of scholars via Twitter and email, and I've gotten some responses, and it's been really fun interacting. And it's definitely, I think, just some of the quick conversations is going to, in the minor edits that I can make here in about the last month, going to make, I think, my project that much better. But anyhow, it's coming close to becoming a reality of actually getting the main edits done before I then move on to some formatting stuff. So that's been encouraging. I'm looking forward to kind of getting it out there. And the fact that at least some folks are taking some interest in it, even if via Twitter and whatnot, it's kind of fun.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
Yeah, me too. I this is all new to me. So yep.
Nice. What's a low light been for you?
One low light, and I didn't want to paint it too negatively here, but we had one of those nights last night where, I was at work all day, came home and got the kids who Jill's been with all day, and it's been a little chaotic. And so, you know, she thought it'd be good for me to take them outside and play. And we did that for a little bit, but it was kind of rainy out. And we went from that to like, oh, dinner needs to be made. And then we needed to run something to my mother-in-law, and then, needed to clean up after dinner, and then needed to get the kids ready for bed. And it just felt like one of those nights where I'm like, you realize it's not a bad thing, I guess, but you realize how sometimes your life as a parent, really, it's not your own, you know, it's not your own, where you're like, man, so much of what we did last night, well, it had nothing to do with what we wanted to do. It had everything to do with making sure that the kids were taken care of, and dinner was made, and dinner was cleaned, and it wasn't a mess. And it's just, it's not the kind of thing you always think about when you think of starting a family and having kids. And it's not that it's a bad thing, but in terms of it being a low light, it is just that kind of the sense of like a whole day can go by where you realize you've been working, you've been setting stuff up for dinner, you're taking care of the kids. And by the end of the day, you're like, oh, that day is gone. You know? So again, I gotta be careful. I don't want to paint it as a low light, as if it's like, this stinks, as much as it is a, like, you know, I always remember hearing from some friends, I think back when I was single, of how, you know, like, you know, it's not so bad to enjoy some of your singleness or your time before kids. Right. I think it's probably moments like this where you realize, you know, this isn't a bad thing, but it certainly requires time and commitment to things that you maybe wouldn't naturally gravitate to if you didn't have kids. Right. You know? Yeah. Does that make sense to you? I mean, you've been there.
It does. It does. I think, you know, my kids are a little older. Our oldest just turned 15 a week ago. And so I think I'm seeing a different side of it a little bit. I mean, there is that. There's the busyness that goes with their schedules. But there's also, I don't know. So like Monday, and this is maybe a low light for me. Like, so we've been getting ready. We've been getting the house ready. We had the realtors come over yesterday and take a look at everything, and trying to get ready for that was pretty intense, in part because we've been doing all this sorting. So everything's just a mess. Right. And we wanted to make it not a mess when the realtors came. And you know, like, you know how sorting can, everything gets worse before it gets better. Yeah. Yep. That's where we were. And then I spent, gosh, I don't know, probably 3 hours at the hardware store, you know, just like trying to problem solve some things for the house to get it ready. And then we had a evening meeting, and all of those things in and of themselves are not bad. But at some point, I mean, I was exhausted. And at some point Jenny mentioned something about like, hey, you should say hi to the kids, because like, because I was just going from task to task to task. And we had dinner together, and I was really out of it because I was just so tired. And I suddenly realized like, oh, that was my only window of time with the kids today, and I missed it. And like, you can't get it back, you know, it's gone. And so I think in some ways it's the flip side of what you're saying, of like how, you know, because of the other pressures of life sometimes, you miss those moments with the kids. So.
Yeah. I felt that too, where I had some realization because Jill had taken, you know, our oldest over to see my mother-in-law, that I think yesterday I saw him for a span of an hour and a half for the whole day. And I'm like, you know, it's just at the end of the day, you're thinking back and you're like, oh man, like, yeah, all of these other things I had to be taken care of, dinner and washing dishes and going to work and all that. At the end of the day, you're like, you know, the people that you're closest to sometimes are the ones that you're spending the least amount of time with. And it's not even because you're intending it that way.
Right.
You know, that's not fun. That's not, I don't know, I guess I have much more about that, but yeah. So is there an insight in there? Is there an unrelated one you wanted to make?
Well, I think, so maybe it's connected, not directly to the kids necessarily, but I think, so every now and then we've been watching a lot less TV recently because we're like, not that we ever watched a whole lot anyway, but we're watching less because we just don't have time. But last night we were watching, there's a show on, I think it's on Netflix called Repair Shop, and it's in the UK somewhere, and people bring in, you know, old things that matter to them. I've seen previews for that. And it's a fun show. It's kind of relaxed. I like that kind of show, like gardening and design and, you know, artisans. I like that kind of thing. Food shows are similar, except that they make me hungry. And so I try not to watch those at night. But anyway, as we were watching it, I was thinking about the stuff as we're getting, you know, we're trying to figure out what are we keeping? What are we taking? You know, what are we getting rid of? And as people were bringing in their stuff to get fixed, the attachment that people had rarely seems to have much to do with the object itself, right? Yeah. It's remembering somebody or remembering some event, but through the object. And so it's interesting thinking about how, as we get ready to get rid of a bunch of stuff, like what memories do we risk losing? Because of, the dislocation of us from our stuff, and not so much stuff as being important to acquire or to maintain because of its stuffness, but because of what it means relationally. And even, you know, sometimes there's identity pieces in there. So there's not really an insight. It's more of just a musing.
Yeah. I totally sympathize with that. I think we experienced that some, this last year when our van broke down, our van wasn't really our van for that long. Our van though was originally purchased in 1998 by my in-laws. They bought it brand new, and they had it all these years. Yes, the red van, you know.
Yeah.
And all those years that they had it, I mean, Jill drove in it, you know, some when she was younger. And then it was the last car that her dad drove.
Oh, how about that?
And the reason why we inherited it was because her dad passed away. So I think there was this sense, like inner sense of lament. Yeah. When it died and we had to get rid of it, because it was like, you know, not the van in of itself, it wasn't that great a condition, you know, there at the end anyways, but it was like, just like you say, the associated memories and the fact that like you're losing something that you associated to with a person you love and care about. Mm-hmm. And there, and now that it's not there, like, you know, hey, trust me, our vehicle that we have now is much better, but it has none of those memories with right. it.
Not yet. I mean, it'll have different memories, so it won't have those memories.
But you don't have those ones. So yeah, I think the point you're making is really interesting. And I, you know, we did a kind of a spring clean a bit this last weekend too.
Yeah.
And similar thing, I think, where Joe was looking through some of the kids' toys.
Yep.
You know, and it was kind of like, oh, they you don't need these anymore. They're not, you know, he's not going to play with these. And for me, you know, I have some memories of them playing with it at this moment or at that moment. Right. And again, I don't care about the toy itself, but you know what you're saying, I think it totally resonate with, because I kind of lamented the idea of getting rid of this or that toy. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, yeah, but what about the time they were playing? As if that's somehow lost now, you know.
But I think so in some ways it kind of can be, because if you don't have the aid for recall, it can kind of go away. It's one of the things I wonder about with the move to all our digital media. You know, you don't stumble across a digital photo in the same way that you stumble across an old box of photos.
And that's a good point.
I don't know. Well, I guess that's an argument for Snapfish or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and on top of that, there's also the fact that, you know, sometimes like when you're seeing objects and you're getting rid of objects, it's also marking out like an interesting period of transition for your kids too, where you're like,
absolutely,
you know, like I can imagine my son, he sleeps with his teddy bear every night, and he has for as long as I can remember. And at a certain point, he's not going to.
Yeah.
And like to get rid of that thing, it's not like again, do I have this affection for the teddy bear? But at the end of the day, it'll be lamentable that you're like that stage is gone, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Cool.
You know, there's been one other highlight for me this week, which is just some of these conversations that have popped up on Patreon with some of the supporters of the podcast.
I totally agree. I haven't been able to give lengthy replies, but some of it is that you've covered some of that already. But I've really appreciated it as well. I mean, our listeners are bringing some fun conversations, especially related to some of the things that we're not able to post in the full podcast episodes. Mm-hmm. But it's a reminder also for our listeners who aren't on there that we do have some sort of extra materials that get posted that contain some conversations that are not happening on the full episode, and some which are very interesting too. Mm-hmm. So you know, and in some ways, even sorry to, you know, I don't think we're selling out, but I mean, in some ways, some of those conversations are even a little more pointed because they're not occurring in the main released episodes, right? So they're they're able to address some things sometimes that maybe are, I don't know, less public, or you don't have to include that, but now I don't want to add too much intrigue, because then there's going to be all these expectations like, ooh, are they saying something? True. Well, it's not so much like that, but you know, and I don't want to give off the impression either that all these are clandestine conversations, you know, that's not the case. Right. So some of those things are just, you know, time-wise, we can't fit them in, and other things though are where they're maybe a little more, you know, appropriate for a smaller group of folks who want to converse with it.
And it is fun just to be able to have a little bit more of a conversation.
It is
one of the weird thing in the podcast, you know, it's like you just send it out there for the world, you know, and it's, I like that on the Patreon to be able to have the conversation back and forth.
We'll be back in a moment with Rachel Pye Jones. We also wanted to let you know a little bit more about our Patreon site, which is at patreon.com/profsandrooms. As Justin mentioned, we also sometimes have exclusive content that we make only for Patreon. For example, in today's episode, the issue of household help comes up in the conversation with Rachel. We have an interesting conversation about the nuances of household help as an expectation in certain communities. And that's available on Patreon. As always, you can find out more about the podcast at profsandrooms.com.
So I'm really excited to have with us today Rachel Pye Jones, who moved to Somaliland in 2003 and has lived in Djibouti since 2004. She and her husband run a school in Djibouti, and she writes about life at the crossroads of faith and culture. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Christianity Today, Runner's World, and more. Her writing is influenced by living in the Horn of Africa, raising third culture kids, and adventurous exploration of the natural world. She's the author of Stronger Than Death, How Annalena Tonelli Defined Terror and Tuberculosis in the Horn of Africa, and her newest book, just out in April, is Pillars, How Muslim Friends Led Me Closer to Jesus. And I have really been enjoying this book. I have some things I want to mention to you about it, so I'll hold off, but it's a wonderful book. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Great. I'm excited to be here with you guys.
Yeah, we're excited to have you, Rachel.
I suppose I should clarify too at some point that we have no known relation.
We're cousins. My husband says every Jones is a cousin.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We usually start by asking our guests kind of I think it's maybe a simple question, but it isn't always, which is, do you drink coffee? And if so, what's the best cup of coffee you've ever had?
I absolutely drink coffee. That is a guarantee. It's hard to say the best cup of coffee I've ever had, but I really love Ethiopian beans, which we can get here pretty easily. You can get them raw in the market and then we roast them, or I can get them already roasted and then just grind them up and make my own coffee in the morning. So that's a must for starting the day.
Nice. Do you have any creative ways that you roast? I know I've got friends that use like little popcorn makers, you know, like the Whirly Pops. I mean,
Yeah. Well, I used to use a Whirly Pop. I feel like it took a really long time. Mm. I don't have a real strong sense that it has to be done a specific way. So I would just do it however it works. So I would take just a basic frying pan on the stove and do it real fast. And I wouldn't say that I'm an expert coffee connoisseur. I like it. I like it to be easy. And so whatever would be easiest, you know, it made the house smell real strong. So my kids weren't really fans of that, but that's all right. I did it anyway.
So how do you brew the coffee then?
Well, we used to use French presses, but they kept breaking.
Right.
I don't know why, but we just kept shattering them. Or sometimes you'd push it down. And once my husband pushed it down and it just came spraying out and it actually burned his stomach pretty badly. Yeah. So we don't usually use French presses anymore. Now I have an Italian coffee maker on the stovetop.
Oh, nice.
And
nice.
I really love that.
Yeah. Steven, it sounds like you're pouring your coffee right now.
I am pouring some more coffee. That is true. So in April of this year, you released a book called Pillars, How Muslim Friends Led Me Closer to Jesus. I think, so as I've been reading your book, it has felt like it has given a space for experiences that I've had, but words that I haven't necessarily had for those experiences. And your experiences go way beyond mine, but there are elements that feel really familiar to me, both in terms of the cross-cultural journey and in terms of being with friends from Muslim backgrounds and like just trying to, I don't know. I think part of what I like so much about your book is that it goes back and forth between, it has this really, I love the narrative feel of the book, but it also has this rich description, but also things that feel very informative. Like I can totally imagine assigning this book for the class that I do on world religions. This would be just, it's such a good place to sit in that space of interaction with other religions. So it's a wonderful book, but what inspired you to write it?
Well, first of all, I feel like you just said, I think two things that I love to hear the most about the book. One is that it puts words to some people's stories. And I just, that means a lot to me because it means that that it's kind of a universal experience, this love for cross-cultural relationships, but it's a complex thing. And so how do we untangle what we're experiencing in that space? So I just love that you felt like it communicated to you in that way. And, and also that, you know, I didn't want to write a book that was like a primer on Islam. There's no way that I can do that. I'm a Christian. Right. A Muslim can do that so much better than me. And also there's such diversity to it. And so the Islam that I was encountering, that I do encounter here, is specific both to Somali culture, Djiboutian culture, but then even more specific to the actual friends that I'm relating with. And they're all different. And so it's hard for me to say this is what Islam is. I didn't want that. I wanted a story that people could really see and understand the personal ways that a Muslim interacts with their faith, the way that a Christian does, that it's unique and special. So that also, I'm really happy that you noticed that about the book. Mm-hmm. And And that kind of highlights, I think, why I felt compelled to write it. Like, well, first of all, I feel like there's so much fear and division and misunderstanding between Muslims and Christians in particular, and just in general in the world right now. A lot of that fear makes us angry and it makes us separate from each other. And yet what I find so meaningful about life here is the way that we can come together across all those differences. It's interesting and it's challenging and it's meaningful. And so I wanted to present a story that could have that kind of feel to it. And when we came to the Horn of Africa back in 2003 from Minnesota, and still today, one of the first questions people ask us is, aren't you afraid? Mm. Aren't you afraid to live in those countries among those people? And no, I'm not actually afraid of Muslims. You know, I'm not afraid they're going to kill us. But I got kind of tired of being told that I should be afraid. And so I wanted to also tell a story that shows how there's nothing really to be afraid of when Muslims are your neighbors and your teachers and your doctors and just a regular life. And then also there's this story for Somalis in particular. And again, this is a little bit interesting. In Minnesota, there's so many Somalis. And so that was part of the draw for us to the Horn. But a lot of the narratives that are in the news or other books about them are all these negative things: war, famine, terrorism, piracy, poverty, all these kinds of things. And yeah, that's true, but there's so much more about Somali culture than that. And so I wanted to tell a different story about Somalis as I've experienced them. Yeah. So just, I mean, all kinds of reasons. Another thing I'm tired of in the Christian story about Christians going across culturally is that there's kind of this triumphant narrative that we have all the answers and we are going to come and fix things and save people. And it really makes us the hero. And I was kind of a disaster in the beginning, especially, but I still am making cultural faux pas all the time. And so I just wanted to kind of overturn all those sort of traditional narratives about faith and Somalis and Christians and cross-cultural life.
I think that's one of the things that I really appreciated in the book is this, the way that you kind of hold up this mirror, right? And say, well, why was I even there? And what, you know, what assumptions did I have about myself and about my own faith? And it's the reflexive feel of the book is really, I think it's, somehow you did it in a way that it is, I hope, approachable for many of my friends and neighbors. Is this a book that you were kind of writing in your head for this whole time? Or was there a moment where you sat down and you're like, okay, now is the time to think of the book to write?
Yeah. So I've been writing these stories down for a long time. I've been blogging for a while. And so I would send stories back to my family or put them on the blog. And I actually thought that I had written this book in 2012, so a long time ago, because I had all the stories, but I didn't really understand what they meant. And so I had tried at that time actually to find a publisher, and I had an agent, and it went nowhere. And she kept telling me there's more here. There's something under the surface here that I wasn't tapping into, right? And so I just put it aside for several years and then kind of went through my own sort of faith questioning and exploring and kind of trying to figure out not just with those stories, particularly what they meant, but even my own self and our life here and what it meant and what it was for and worth. And then those things sort of collided about 2.5-3 years ago. And I went back to those stories and thought, oh, I think I understand this better. And then the book came out of that.
That's really rich.
You know, what I found interesting too, even about the title of your book, not just Pillars, but How Muslim Friends Led Me Closer to Jesus, is that as I feel like, you know, for students of ours, Stephen and I here at the college, I feel like some might maybe like take that as almost like a threatening title or something. The idea that as Christians, somehow we can learn something about God and about Jesus from people with other religious convictions. I don't know, how do you wrestle through with that? Because I'm very sympathetic, I think, to what you're doing in the book there. And I'm so glad that you're exploring some of those things. You know, for students maybe who, you know, who feel tension when they hear that, you know, I don't know, how would you speak just to that particular question?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I have several ways of thinking about that. A major one for me is humility. I just don't think that any one person, especially myself, has it all figured out about who God is and what God does in the world and how God interacts with people or people with God. And so to think that my limited experience, even though I've lived abroad in all these years, it's still limited to my life, my personality, where I'm from, where I live now. And one of the things I've learned about God from living abroad is just how much bigger God is than what I thought. And so to imagine that I know enough or know it all, I think that would just be fairly arrogant. And so it comes down to a sense of humility. And then I do think that God is active everywhere in every person. Every person is made in the image of God. And so in some way, everybody, whether they're a Muslim or a Christian or a Buddhist or no faith at all, I believe we are always interacting with God on some level. And so I think we can always be learning from different people's experiences, you know, how God speaks into our fear or our pain or our joy, how we are taking delight in various things. And so, you know, I can ask my friends, how are you experiencing God when you pray? And what they communicate back to me, I think it could communicate something to my faith, even if I disagree with it. So that's important too. Like I can disagree with them and then that can make me learn something about God or about my relationship with God in a different way. And if we are really, I think this is what I would encourage students, my own kids, actually they're college students right now. Mm-hmm. And what I encourage them, two of my three kids, is as you are really grounded in your own faith and what you understand about God and how much you love Jesus and what you know about the Bible, let that groundedness open you up instead of feeling threatened by someone else's belief system that's different than yours. Know what you believe and be confident in that, but then let that open you up. So you're not being opened up in the sense of being opened up so that you'll question or doubt or have to overturn your own things, but just to say, okay, that's what you believe. And here's what I believe. That's okay. Let's explore God together. And so I think I encourage students to really go deep in confidence in being rooted in their own faith and then to let that open them up to curiosity.
I really appreciate that approach. I remember when I graduated from college, I felt some tension myself as I was, you know, removing myself from my largely Christian community in a Christian college to then just living in the world where there's many people with very different beliefs and different thoughts. And I remember encountering some of that tension because I think I maybe implicitly picked up on, maybe even explicitly, the idea that like, be careful who you talk with about religion, because somehow you're like, quote unquote, opening yourself up to like potential deception or something like that. So I always approached talking with people of other religions with a very fear-based approach, like, how might this lead me down a slippery slope or something? Mm-hmm. But what you're saying, I think, is so, so powerful and meaningful, especially for students or people who are going through those experiences, because I think now I look back on hindsight and I had a professor in seminary who encouraged the same, I think, mindset that you're saying here, which is, you know, if you're grounded in your own faith, like go with an openness and you don't have anything really to fear, it can actually be a positive experience. And I think that's such a more helpful approach than this sense of look out. You never know how Satan might twist something, you know, and then it really demonizes, I mean, not just metaphorically, but literally demonizes other human beings just on the basis of them holding different beliefs. So I really appreciate what you have to say on that, because it's such an important thing, especially for people who might be coming out of a context like I had.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there's a lot of things that the church has not done everything well, you know? So in terms of my upbringing, we did not talk about race well. We didn't even really talk about it at all. And so for me to come here where I'm now in Africa, I need to learn about race from the people around me. And there are other things that the church hasn't always done well in certain denominations or churches or whatever. And so we have to be able to experience and learn from other people too, because we don't have it all solved yet. And so, especially I think about race, that's something that I need to learn from other people about.
It's interesting because part of what it sounds like you're describing is there's this rootedness that gives you the ability to be generous in your interaction with others, but it also gives you the space to be able to look at your own faith. So it's like rootedness is not the same as, I don't know, building a castle around your faith, right? With a moat around it. It's like you have this very central core solid reality. And then everything that isn't that is something that can be brought into question. But it sounds like maybe part of what you are talking about and part of what you do in Pillars is to kind of examine things that maybe used to be core, like they used to feel like they were part of that core. And then you realize like, actually that isn't, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I think when people start to kind of look at that core and examine it again, we call it deconstruction or, and then reconstruction that happens at that time. And one of the ways I think about that is that I feel like living here has caused me to do that in kind of a cyclical pattern over and over, maybe not cyclical, spiral, moving up or down, deeper and deeper into who God is, like constantly unpacking something and then repacking it and then taking it out again and looking at it. When I think about that process of what it's been like to examine my core beliefs, again, I think about when Jesus says in Matthew 13, he's talking about how every teacher of the law who's been instructed in the kingdom, I'm not a teacher of the law, but I have been instructed through the New Testament in the kingdom of heaven. They're like the owner of a house who brings out of the storeroom new treasures as well as old treasures. And so for me, I feel like living here has allowed me to sort of dig into the storehouse of my faith and pull out new treasures and old treasures and see them in fresh ways, if that makes sense. And so Jesus both looks different and fresher in some ways, and then new ideas and old ideas get sort of untangled and reconstructed. So, I mean, specifically some that I had to get rid of. One big one was that God needed me in some way, that I was going to be central to getting things done here, or that I had nothing to learn. Those two things are really significant ones that I think come from, so that groundedness can easily veer into arrogance and a sense of being central. And so, or, you know, and then the lack of curiosity or thinking that I don't have anything to learn. So I had to get rid of that stuff. And it was pretty obvious when we got to Somalia in particular that I had a lot to learn, not only in terms of faith, but just regular life. You know, I didn't know how to physically get to the market. I couldn't speak complete sentences to people. And so immediately all these cultural things that I relied on to survive and to feel like a human in the world, I couldn't do very well. And so I had to learn those basic things. And then eventually that became deeper and deeper into some of the spiritual things. One of the things that I think has been really foundational for me is to recognize, working on recognizing even more, recognize the lenses with which I see the world. And so, you know, I would look at people and define them in reference to myself. So Christians talk a lot about non-Christians, un-Christians, unbelievers. And so we're constantly defining the other person through our experience of faith. But what that fails to do is it doesn't let that person be who they are. And so a Muslim doesn't consider themselves a non-believer. They consider themselves a deep believer.
Yeah.
And the way that really came home to me was that one of the first words I learned in Somalia was infidel. And everybody was calling me the infidel. I was the outsider, the one who didn't have any faith. And I at first was really offended by that because, and I couldn't quite articulate it at the time yet in Somali, but no, I'm a person of deep faith. Part of the reason that I came here is because of my faith. I'm motivated by Jesus to love people. And so to be called an unbeliever was kind of hurtful. And then all of a sudden I realized, oh, that's what I've been doing to Muslims all this time, or to people of, you know, different faiths. And so it took me that experience of being the one who's the outsider and being seen through their lenses and defined by the majority lens, which I wasn't a part of. It took that experience to see my lenses that I brought, and then, you know, still trying to take some of them off. But as I've done that, I've been able to see people more in terms of how they see themselves and define themselves. And then we can meet in a more authentic way.
What has the process been like for you in terms of, you know, moving away from, say, like your home culture of Minnesota and then moving into an environment that's different than that? Has that in any way caused you to look back at certain areas of just the way you practice Christianity or the way that you thought about God as being sort of entrenched in certain American cultural values? Because I've wondered that, and, you know, that's not to demonize that in particularly, because, you know, I think in many ways, I mean, that's what we have to do, right? We have to contextualize the gospel for our way of seeing the world. But I kind of wonder what the experience is like sometimes for people who remove themselves from their home cultures, and whether that can bring any clarity to the things that maybe look back on and go, oh, those things maybe aren't core things of Christianity, but there's certain expressions and even cultural expressions of Christianity that may not transcend all cultures. Have you have you noticed some of those things yourself?
Yeah, definitely. I think two immediately come to mind, and one is more of a negative, I think, and I don't want to come down on the American church negatively, mm-hmm. but there is a strong consumer culture that mm-hmm. infiltrates the church. I remember one week we were back in the summer time in Minnesota, and it felt like every meeting I was at, I was told to buy something, whether it was a book or pay for a conference or, you know, buy coffee. There was always this something that I needed to have in order to really practice my faith in that community. Right. And it was about money. And then of course you have all the, you know, the trinkets and the things that are, that have, you know, Jesus on them in some way.
All the bracelets really, and the buttons and everything.
Yeah, exactly. And that just doesn't, we don't wear that stuff here. I don't want it even. And that came very clear for me at one moment here when I'd been at an Easter party with our kids and someone had brought a package of stuff from the United States that had, you know, eggs with crosses on them and candy bracelets with Jesus saves, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I came home from this party. I left this stuff on the table in our kitchen and our housekeeper came the next morning and she saw it and she was just horrified that we mm-hmm. had these coloring books with pictures of Jesus in them. They never draw mm-hmm. the prophet Muhammad mm-hmm. or that we had kind of made these really sacred symbols into toys for kids. Mm-hmm. And it was so disrespectful in her opinion to the holiness of God. And that conversation we had in the moment really showed me how that didn't translate here and even what that could look like. And I understand, you know, there's positive things about it, but it's just not something that, that I appreciate anymore. Another thing that comes to mind about, you know, kind of comparing the two experiences of church is the individual nature mm-hmm. of my faith when I'm in the United States versus here, in particular in terms of worship. There's all kinds of different ways it manifests itself, but when I go to church, we could easily walk into our church building in Minnesota and walk back out as a family and not engage with any people. Mm-hmm. We sit in our pew and we listen to the preacher and we sing our songs and then we walk out and we go home. But here, the church is so small. And when I think of church, I think of the actual body of believers, the people who make up the church. And so we do have a building we go to, but we meet throughout the week and we pray for each other and we go for long walks together and we talk about the Bible together. Like we're very much engaged in each other's lives. When one of us needs a COVID test, someone from the church will bring them to get the test. Or if they need food at the hospital, someone from the church will bring it to them. Like we're very much integrated in each other's actual daily lives. And I love that about being the church here. I think, again, partly because we are the minority. And so we rely on each other in unique ways. Whereas in the U.S. in a massive church, you don't have the same need to really depend on each other. You can, you know, get that from other places. And so I've really come to appreciate the communal nature of the church here compared to that individual sense of a Sunday morning service in the U.S.
Do you mean to say that they don't sell testaments in Djibouti? Have you seen those testaments?
I've seen them, yes.
Oh, man. I used to work at a Christian bookstore here in the Twin Cities right after high school. And yeah, we had all the plethora of Christian paraphernalia, of which I was an avid consumer at the time. It's like, I kind of felt like, well, you know, it's like you blend your faith in with everything you buy. And it's so interesting what you're pointing out, because it's definitely something that it's like we're a fish in water sometimes. And yes, we don't even realize that those things have become immersed in our faith. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate some of the things you're noticing there.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've noticed, I don't know, maybe in the last 10 years or so, is it seems like many American Christians can't imagine that it's possible, and certainly not that it's good sometimes for the church to exist in a minority context. And of course, historically, there have been plenty of examples, and around the world today, there are plenty of examples where Jesus followers are in the minority somewhere. But it seems like that has led us sometimes as the American church into this space of feeling like we need to defend being in the majority. And so then we get all off-centered, because then we're actually defending something that has nothing to do with Jesus, but has to do with, you know, power, or has to do with influence in society or things like that. What have you observed being part of a minority faith community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really well put what you said. And we have here three church buildings that are sanctioned to exist. So one is Ethiopian Orthodox, one is Protestant, and one is Catholic, the cathedral. And they actually do have crosses on top of the buildings. But, you know, to participate in that community really means something here in a different way. And to be honest, the church service maybe doesn't feed me. It doesn't feed me as much as feed me in terms of the teaching that I get out of it, or the feeling you get from the music, things like that, because it's a little bit more simplistic, because we're dealing with people of multi-linguistic backgrounds, French speakers, English speakers, Korean, all kinds of different things. We don't actually right now have a trained pastor who brings the word. We have a member of the community who brings a sermon. And so what I expect out of that church is very different being in the minority. I think I expect the community, and I expect the value of communicating to the majority culture that we care about each other, that mm-hmm. this body of believers who are literally from all over the globe, where there's only, 30 or 40 of us on a week, that we care about each other. And that even though we can't communicate fluently, and even though we have different faith traditions that we bring into this actual service, it matters to us to participate in the global body of Christ. And that feels really important to me in a mm-hmm. different way than going to church in the US feels, where I might get more personally out of it, but it means less culturally. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, when I say to someone like a Djiboutian Muslim here that I go to this church and that I worship alongside a Korean and a Congolese and a Nigerian, and that we are committed to each other, that communicates something beautiful about the power of the gospel. And so I think that comes from being in a minority community.
And what you're describing there is so beautiful in a lot of ways, because I wonder, we don't want to idealize even the New Testament churches, but there's something that you're describing there that I imagine to be maybe more similar to what the circumstances were in the New Testament eras, where you'd have churches, scattered across the Roman Empire, and not many of them, if any of them, had an Apostle Paul or a Peter there who was, systematically unpacking the scriptures and explaining Jesus. It was probably a lot of narrative telling. It was probably a lot of praying together and having community together. And so the idea somehow that you have these like polished expository preachers in the New Testament era would have been quite rare. You have volunteers mm-hmm. who are working, in their normal everyday life, who are showing up on a Sunday and contributing to these communities. So I appreciate what you're saying, because in some ways it strips away, it can strip away some of the things that we've made the big deal with churches mm-hmm. in America that maybe sometimes it could be beneficial to scale back some. So, I'm sure you could testify to the things you might, miss about what that context maybe sometimes can't mm-hmm. bring, but there seems to be something beautiful about it too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hear from a lot of American Christian friends, actually, they talk a lot about feeling very lonely, even in a church service. And part of me feels like maybe the problem is the pews are all facing forward. It's about that mm-hmm. expository preacher, and it's not about the community. But what if we can all get our sermons on, it's not the same, but we can get some sermons from podcasts and other places. Yeah. But what we need from each other is community. And of course, with COVID, that's really been highlighted. But mm-hmm. but I do feel that here, that sense of community, it's so precious, and it communicates something radical to mm-hmm. the world, mm-hmm. the way that we love each other. And so that even in itself is important.
One of the things that's really interesting is when you think of yourself as central to the activity of God in the world, there's so many bad things that can come with that. The expectations you have of yourself, the expectations of how others will respond to you. But I think also that one of the things that you problematize in the book is that idea that the safest place in the world to be is in the center of God's will. And kind of this, this reality that sometimes following God and living, walking with God means that you may not be okay. And what was that like for you? Just like realizing that your safety wasn't guaranteed?
Hard. It was hard. And, the book opens with one of the hardest things that happened. It was a long time ago now, but we had to actually flee violence in Somalia, and we had to abandon our home. I had 30 minutes to pack up a suitcase and throw the kids in the car and try to get out of the country. And I didn't go back from 2003 until 2014. And so, that was really hard, and it overturned all these ideas we'd had about what life would look like, how long we would stay, what it was all for. Even though we knew again, you know these things, but to experience it, it's a whole different level. We knew it was Somalia. We knew something might happen. And yet when it happened, it was still a shock. And so recognizing and really reckoning with the reality that we are not safe. Three foreigners had been murdered, and one of them was in our own village. And there was only at that time, 8 or 9 adult foreigners in the village. So it, you know, there's a high possibility that it could have been one of us, or we had kids, they were easy targets, all those kinds of things. And so we reckoned with that, or we had to wrestle with it. Although I don't think that that wrestling ever ends. I think we always still want to believe that we're going to be safe. Mm-hmm. But I've learned over the years to just really, as much as I can, relinquish that as an idol, that I cannot protect my family. And I value some of these things enough that we will take certain risks because I know I can't protect them anyway. So, you know, I decided to give birth to our third child here, which a lot of people felt like was taking an unnecessary risk. Even I wrote about it for the New York Times, and one woman commented on that article that it was irresponsible for women to give birth in Africa.
What? Wow. Wait.
Yeah, I mean, how do you even respond to that? You know, I think what she meant was that it was maybe irresponsible for me as a white American, but I didn't want to grab hold of any kind of privilege to get. I wanted to identify with my friends here and do this here. But I remember even at the time really thinking, you know, I'm trusting you for this, God, almost like a wager. If I decide to give birth here, then you're going to guarantee the healthy birth, right? But no, I mean, I did have a healthy birth. It went really well, but that's not a guarantee. And so I've had to just really wrestle with that over and over throughout the years as things happen. You know, whether you're here or in the United States, I don't know anybody who's going to avoid pain and avoid suffering. And so we have to be willing to say safety is not everything perfect and everything healthy. It just has to, we have to rest in God being with us, God holding us, taking us through things, you know, committing to each other, to love each other through it. But we cannot hold safety as the idol and the end all.
It sounds like that's another one of those things that I think particularly in the versions of American Christianity that I'm most familiar with, safety is one of those things that is actually a core belief and doesn't belong there. It's not actually part of the gospel. And one of those things that sometimes makes up part of that castle that has to be taken apart.
It's about control, right? Safety is about control. And we cannot control. I think COVID again exposes that. I've walked through cancer myself. I didn't pick that. I didn't control that. And so those kinds of experiences just really expose the idol of safety and the way that we're trying to wrestle control back from God instead of just resting in his goodness toward us and his ultimate purposes for us.
Yeah, I feel like we can even perpetuate that by going to some of the passages in the Old Testament, New Testament, where God does show us some miraculous protection over people. And I always find it a little bit troubling when I'm teaching through Acts that, you know, a lot of people will go to the times when some of the apostles are miraculously, you know, let out of prison or things like that. And then yet within a couple of chapters in Acts, James is killed by Herod. Within a couple of decades, you know, both Peter and Paul are killed in Rome, you know, which we don't get in the New Testament, but which is pretty well attested in the early church. And so we kind of like to pick the narratives that will in the scriptures that will perpetuate that myth of safety without seeing the total story, which is that it's just way more messy than that. And then we don't know always how to piece together, how do we trust God if God isn't guaranteeing us that safety? And yet like, isn't that's, it's kind of, it's ignoring some of the ways within which the, even the early apostles had to trust God in the midst of not having that guarantee. So I was floored when you brought that up early in your book, because I think it started to put language to something I've been wrestling with for a while, especially in the COVID era, when I've heard from some Christian friends like, oh, I'm not bothered by COVID. Like, God's got my back. And in some ways, my thought has been like, okay, yeah, have faith and trust God. But where did you get such guarantee? I'm like, if James didn't get it, you know, if Stephen didn't get it, you know, and I'm thinking about all these other apostolic witnesses. I'm like, well, then why do we think we have it? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I find that really helpful what you brought up there. And it really can kind of dismantle some of those myths of safety that we've latched onto.
And what does that do to faith? If that's the kind of faith you have in God, that you won't suffer, and then you suffer, where does that leave you? It leaves you with a shattered faith. And so, you know, how I communicate with my kids or how we communicate with our family back in the United States is never that we're going to guarantee safety, because what do you do? None of it. We're all going to die. You know, none of us are immortal. And so, yeah, it just, we need to have a bigger, more robust, complicated faith.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. Part two of the conversation with Rachel gets into more questions about what she has learned from her Muslim friends as a follower of Jesus, and was really fascinating to us. Please comment, like, and share. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.